This is Mame Warren. Today is the 27th of January, 1997. I'm in Tampa, Florida with Tom Touchton. And I got to tell you, I've really been looking forward to this because yours was one of the first names that was brought up to me when I started this job, because Frank Parsons was just really, really interested in the whole fraternity renaissance. And he says you're a key player. So we will get to that, but I'd rather start off by asking you how a Florida boy got to Lexington, Virginia in the first place.
I grew up in a small town called Dade City, Florida. Probably when I was a junior or so in high school and was starting to think about college, and I had always thought I would go to the University of Florida and be a Florida Gator fan. But my parents had the wisdom to suggest that I go farther away from home than Gainesville, Florida, which was 100 miles away. And in fact suggested that I consider various liberal arts colleges around the Southeast. I was a small town guy, so they probably thought I would be more comfortable at a place like a Washington and Lee or a Davidson or a Swanee. And since my mother's family had originally come from Virginia a long time ago, she had a special spot in her heart for Virginia. And of course, Washington and Lee had a top reputation, and so she suggested that perhaps I look at Washington and Lee. And I sent off for the catalog. I remember being very impressed with the catalog and the various attributes of Washington and Lee, particularly the honor system. And when it came time to apply to college, I didn't have any better sense than to send my application into Washington and Lee and just wait. That is, today I would probably apply to a dozen schools hoping one of them might take me, but then I didn't know any better. So I applied to Washington and Lee, and of course Dean Gillum was the dean at that time, and that's how I ended up at Washington and Lee.
Well, wait a minute. What do you mean? If Dean Gillum was the dean, why did that mean you wound up at Washington and Lee?
Well, I guess I was maybe jumping ahead of myself because I, of course, didn't know who Dean Gillum was. But while my application was pending at Washington and Lee, my father, who was in the life insurance business, had a meeting at the Greenbrier. So I went as a senior in high school in probably March of 56, went to the Greenbrier with them for a meeting, and not having seen Washington and Lee since I was perhaps 10 or 12 or 14 years old, I didn't visit it in 1956 the way most students would try to do now. So when the meeting at the Greenbrier was over, we drove over to Lexington, and I went to Dean Gillum's office to try to determine whether or not I had been accepted or when would I know whether I would be accepted. He not only confirmed that I had been accepted and that perhaps the letter was either en route to Dade City at that moment or would be soon, but he suggested that I go down to the freshman dorm and pick out a room that I liked and come back and tell him which room that was and that I could live there my freshman year. And I thought a wonderful touch. He was a very special guy.
So did you form a relationship with him through the years?
Just a casual but very friendly one. I remember in those days every student, as I recall, would receive once or twice or three times a year a note from Dean Gillum indicating that you were invited to his office at a particular time and date, and invited means you were expected to be there, of course. So I would show up for my appointment, and it was Dean Gillum's way of staying in touch with students and getting to know them and finding out how they were doing and were they happy or unhappy and what were they involved in. And he usually knew more about you than you had any idea, but he was really a very special person.
The place does have that personal touch, doesn't it?
It does, he still, of course.
Now, you also mentioned the honor system.
Yeah.
So you knew about the honor system before you arrived?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
What did it mean to you?
I don't know that I had ever thought of colleges or schools having an honor system. I went to a public high school in Dade City, but I don't think there was ever any talk of an honor system. No, there was no official honor system. There was, I guess it's easier to say, in the 50s there was maybe more honor then. The values were more conservative in a small town in Florida. And so while I and the people I knew lived within a boundary of honor, I think having it exist at a in an institution of people who otherwise would be strangers who've come together from different backgrounds all over the country, I just thought that was a very nice attribute. That I liked what it said about the institution, that it would care about honor.
Do you remember how it was explained to you when you got there?
No, I really don't. I remember that we had freshman camp in those days down at Natural Bridge, and I have to believe there were one or more speakers who appeared before the freshmen who would tell us about the honor system and how it worked, what the process was, what the penalties were, and so forth. But I don't remember any specifics of that.
And as you were there for 4 years, did you see the honor system at work? Was it an awareness that was always there, or?
Absolutely. I think there was always part of it was a fear that you would do something wrong and inadvertently, and it would be an honor system. So I think people were very careful not to do anything that might be considered an honor system. I remember my roommate and I. He couldn't spell very well, he would, this was a little thing, but he would ask me how to spell certain words, and I would tell him I didn't know if I was supposed to answer questions about a paper he was working on, and he would have to look it up in the dictionary, and it used to drive him crazy to have to look something up in the dictionary when I could have spelled the word for him. But so we were careful, and I remember the notices that might appear on a bulletin board that someone had withdrawn from school because of an honor violation, but I don't remember a lot of conversation about it. I remember the pledge that we had to sign in our blue books and on exams or papers, but I don't remember a lot of conversation. It seems to me it almost just happened, just was reinforced constantly, and I would say I think that's true today, and I find in talking with alumni that the honor system must be the single attribute that alumni talk to me about the most, have spoken to me about over the years. And it's something when I interview prospective students, I always ask them if they don't volunteer the information, I always ask them if they were familiar with the Bevanel Honor System and what did they think about it and what did it mean to them. And sometimes I've even said, if you think you would have any problem living in a community that had an honor system, you really better think about going somewhere else. And so students think about it today who are going there and find it very appealing, and alumni remember it very strongly.
It's a wonderful system to live with, mm-hmm. even as a witness to it.
Yes, it is.
It's a very nice. Another thing that I'm very struck by, and I presume was very active at the time you were there, was a speaking tradition. Can you tell me about that?
We certainly had one. I rather liked it. It certainly fit me being from a small town. Those have small town people speak rather routinely. I was sorry to see it go by the boards. I still practice it when I visit the campus, and I think my generation probably, everyone in my generation probably does, more or less. So I'm sorry it disappeared, but you know, some things change.
Oh, it's active. Well,
yes, it is. And it's the fact that it's voluntary instead of required, because we used to have, if I'm not mistaken, was it the assimilation committee that would punish you if you didn't speak or something? And maybe that's artificial. Maybe it's better for it to be more impromptu or honest rather than forced or required. But I think, like some other rules, having to do something reinforces the doing of it and carries on a tradition or a process I think the speaking tradition has served them well. Really.
Now, a couple of times you've mentioned this idea of being from a small town, and you certainly went to a small town when you went to Lexington. What were your impressions of the town?
Don't know that I had any special impressions. I'm glad I chose a small town instead of a city. I experienced the sense of community there that I would have known in Dade City, and that I was involved in the Presbyterian Church there, right in the center of town, and I would go to a faculty member's home, or I gave you the slide of Dr. Wheeler, who at one point was one of my faculty members and advisors, and I remember going to his home for dinner. I don't remember anything special about it, except very comfortable.
Were there any particular hangouts in those days where you would go?
Gosh. I don't remember the names anymore. Movie houses. Don't remember the names.
Movie houses, movies were a big thing?
Yes. Flicks, I think we call them. I don't remember, can't remember any names of places.
Now, something you mentioned when you first were talking about choosing Washington Lee, you mentioned being a football fan. Were you there at the height of the Lee McLaughlin era, or did that come just after you?
I don't remember when he was there. I went in 56. What I remember about going there was the cheating scandal had been about 2 years before, 54, maybe 53.
Yes, 54.
And so my year was either the first or second year that WL had a football team again after the cheating scandal. And who the coach was, I don't remember.
Was there much school spirit? Was there much team spirit then?
I don't recall a lot of football team spirit. I recall a lot of intramural team spirit.
Tell me about that.
Through the fraternities. W&L, of course, is always, I don't always, for certainly decades, has had a, through the fraternity system, has had a very strong intramural program competition among the fraternities. And I remember that competition and spirit being very strong, very competitive. I remember we had a very good basketball team in those years because for some reason, and I don't remember why, we still had several players on basketball scholarships, so that while the Board of Trustees had de-emphasized or had maybe even abolished subsidized athletics, there were still a handful of basketball players who were on scholarship, so the quality of the basketball was really quite good. And so I remember people getting very excited about some of the big basketball games. And I think I remember we played UVA and others, and we'd go to Charlottesville for a UVA basketball game or something.
You mentioned your faculty advisor. I always think it's kind of important that we get around to talking about academics while I do these interviews.
Right.
Washington really often puts its emphasis on other things, but I think that that's a real important thing to talk about. Were there any teachers who really made a difference for you? Any really special?
Oh, yes. In fact, I have a special story to tell on that. My faculty advisor my freshman year was Sid Cowling. I think it was his first year. He was an alumnus, of course, but I think it was his first year as a faculty member in the English department. And I did well in his course and always admired him as a person. But the interesting aspect of that is that 30 years later, when our son was going to W&L as a freshman, and I was on the Board of Trustees at the time, and I called Dean of Freshmen Bob Huntley and said, "Bob, I'm a little nervous about bringing this up, but I need a favor." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "I would like for John to have a good faculty advisor, but I don't know who the good ones are." I said, "I have to believe that in the range of good to bad, there are some that are better than others, and I would just like for John to have a good faculty advisor, whoever that is." And he said, "Well, who would you like for him to have?" And I said, I don't have a clue. I said, "I'll leave that entirely up to you." And he was quiet for a minute, and he said, "Well, who did you have when you were a freshman?" And I said, "Well, I had Sid Cowling." And he says, "Well, how about Sid Cowling?" And I said, "Well, I know Sid is in the process of retiring, and I can't believe Sid wants to be bothered with freshman advisees anymore." And he said, "Well, why don't I ask him?" And I I said, well, if that's who you think would be a good faculty advisor for John, then I think that would be terrific. Well, Bob Huntley did mention it to Sid Cowling. Sid was delighted, and I think John, our son John, and one other freshman possibly of the same situation were the only two faculty advisees that Sid Cowling had that year. So, and I think it was his last year on the faculty, so I had Sid Cowling my freshman year, and my son did 30 years later, and I wouldn't think that happens very often. And that reminds me to tell you that when John, my son, came after he had been accepted by W&L, came to me one day and said, Dad, I have all these housing forms here. Do you have any thoughts about what kind of room I ought to have at W&L in the freshman dorm? And I said, well, the first question would be, do you want to have a roommate? Do you want a single room or a double room? Do you want a roommate or not? And he said, I think I'd like a single room. And I said, okay. And it happened at that time that I was on the campus life committee of the boards, and I happened to keep a lot of my W&L board material at home. So I reached for a diagram of the freshman dorm, Graham Lee's dorm, and found the room that I had had when I was a freshman. And I said, John, here is a single corner room. It says here that it's room, I think it was 125. I said, I have to believe if you write back to the housing office and say that your father went to W&L and he had room 125 in 1956, and if that room has not been assigned to anyone, that you would like to have it when, as a freshman. I said, the kind of place that W&L is, they are more likely than not to give you that room. Well, in fact, they did. And so not only did John and I have the same faculty advisor 30 years apart, but we lived in the same dorm rooms 30 years apart.
That's wonderful.
Great story.
That
great
is W&L. So Washington and Lee.
Great W&L story.
That is marvelous. Oh, that's very sweet. That's very sweet. It must have, I assume it was very flattering to you to have John choose Washington and Lee.
Well, I think I played that right by encouraging him to look at Dartmouth and UVA and Georgetown.
And it was clear that he wanted Washington and Lee.
He did, and I was delighted.
Is this father's pride, or is this something? Okay. I didn't know whether there was something I was touching on that I shouldn't be.
No, not at all.
Well, that makes it all the more special.
Not at all.
Well, we could go about five different directions at this point. We've touched on so many things, but I'm going to pull us back to 1956.
Okay.
And ask you to tell me about Sid Cowley in 1956.
Well, I don't remember much, except Sid Cowling is, of course, a gentleman and a great teacher. And I couldn't possibly have appreciated then how good he was, but he's a wonderful human being and became, of course, one of the great statesmen on the faculty. And it's been a pleasure to see him from time to time and to when I was involved in Dublin in different ways to try to get a perspective that would help me in whatever deliberations might go on. I remember co-education being one. And he's such a high quality person and thoughtful and gentle. And but I must confess, I don't remember anything about the classroom. I just remember him as a person with all the characteristics I just mentioned.
I just think that would have been thrilling to be there for the beginning of his career. I guess it would have taken a lot of foresight to realize what an important career that was that you were witnessing. But he's one of my very favorite people.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a clue, of course, that you know, how well he would do, but he was as good as I ever had, and I'm sure others feel that way too.
What was your major?
Political science. Why was it political science? I think I started out, I don't remember when one had to declare a major, maybe sophomore year. And I think I started out as an economics major and had Harvey Wheeler for my sophomore political science class, I think. And I think because of Dr. Wheeler, I changed my major to political science. Today it'd be history, but I didn't know any better then.
I don't know the name Harvey Wheeler at all. He's obviously very important to you, but tell me about him.
Well, gosh, I don't know much. He was one of the rising stars in the W&L faculty at the time. I don't remember what his academic background had been. He co-authored, maybe with a fellow named Burdick, the novel, I think it was Failsafe.
Oh, yes.
I think he co-authored that maybe was published about that time. I remember how brilliant he was and how freeform his lectures were. By freeform, I mean that when it's not only applied to the political science course, but it applied almost to any individual lecture, he would start his lecture and would sort of ramble and ramble and ramble, and you would wonder, where in the world is this man trying to go? And he would drop pieces of information all along the way, and you were trying to take notes. And by the end of the lecture, and then by the end of the course, somehow he would wrap it all together in just almost a miraculous way. And I wouldn't call him a spellbinding lecture. He was really rather dry. But he was so smart, and the way he designed and delivered a lecture, he really brought in politics and philosophy and religion and history and sort of wrapped it all in one. It was really quite good. And so the slide I gave you, I just happened to have that one. Wish I'd had one of Sid Cowling, but. But Harvey Wheeler then left Washington and Lee before I graduated, I think, and went to a think tank in California, maybe the Rand Corporation. And we never stayed in touch or anything like that, but he was a brilliant professor.
Were there, you say he wasn't a spellbinding lecturer?
Well, I guess he was intellectually, but he wasn't in the delivery.
Were there other people who were?
I remember two. One was Dean Lou Adams in the Commerce School, who I think maybe taught economics or forgotten what he taught, but Lou Adams was a very interesting professor and teacher, and I remember what he, this wasn't exactly in the précis of the course, but he was very involved in a number of things, maybe off campus as well as on, and so he would bring anecdotes and stories into the classroom, and we probably spent half the time talking about things that were happening out in the world versus whatever it was we were supposed to be dealing with in the chapter of a particular book. And so because he was talking about contemporary things, he was spellbinding. Dr. Griffith, who had taught comparative economic systems, I think, he was very good. And there's one more I was thinking of. Ross Borden, who was an English teacher my senior year. I thought he was a very good lecturer and teacher. Of course, the all-time award-winning spellbinder was WNL's president,
Francis Pendleton Gaines.
Pendleton Gaines. He was a spellbinder.
Tell me about him.
Well, he was as everyone knows, a great orator in the old school sense, old world sense, and we had freshmen in those days were required to attend certain functions in, I guess it was the gymnasium. I guess that's where we had our required attendance. Certain convocations, Founders Day probably. And Dr. Gaines frequently was the speaker for those functions. And I think he was inspiring and a great role model relative to encouraging young people A, to behave in a certain way, and B, to love Washington and Lee. He did that very well.
I've heard some tapes of his speeches.
Oh, and I haven't. I'd like to hear some tapes of his speeches.
Oh, well, I'll make a copy of it and send it down to you.
I'd love to. And I bet if there is a way that the Alumni Magazine could advertise the availability of speeches by Dr. Gaines, or if there are any conversations with Dean Gillum or something like that, I bet there would be a huge. I think there would be a substantial level of inquiry, expression of interest from alumni about those two men in particular.
Well, my husband says that my job will not be complete until I do an interview with Robert E. Lee. But to tell you the truth, as much as I'd like to talk to Lee, I'd like to talk to Francis Pendleton Gaines and Frank Gillum just as much, to tell you. Those names, I feel as if I know them. So many people have talked about them.
That has to be true.
Especially Gaines. He just seems like such a character. Now, you were there at the transition time when President Cole came in. Is that right?
Yes, but I don't remember much about that. So I was not a very good student. I was not very involved in the life of the school when I was there, and I think that's one of the reasons I was so pleased later to have an opportunity to serve on the Board of Trustees, because it gave me a chance to give back then when I really didn't do much giving back when I was there, because I was spending too much time trying to figure out who I was and where I was going.
Well, that's interesting.
But I don't remember anything really about that transition. I mean, I gave you the slide of Fred Cole, but I don't. I remember what he looked like, but I didn't know him at all. I don't have any memories there.
Now, as a political science major, did you get involved with the mock convention?
Not particularly. I remember going to it, but I was not involved in it.
I would think that would have been a particularly interesting one, since you all did nominate Kennedy, I think, wasn't that one? I think that was one of the years you got it right. And I would think
think
Washington
right.
and Lee, that would have been a tough call.
I don't remember, to be perfectly honest. Okay. I don't know.
Well, I'd like to find somebody who was real involved with that mock convention, because I just think I know how conservative the student body is, and that would have been a tough call to make.
You know what I would do, I don't know where these records are, but I have to believe there are records readily available about who the student leaders were
mm-hmm.
in the mock convention in 1960, and you could either ask around campus or you could call me and I could tell you who would be a couple of wonderful people to talk to from that time period
uh-huh.
who would have been who are gabbers. I mean, you know, who would talk to you about that.
Oh yeah, I need gabbers. I definitely need gabbers. So let's see. How about Dean Leyburn? I guess he wasn't dean by the time you got there. Was he someone you interacted with?
Unfortunately not. And one of my great regrets from my W&L years was I never had him as a teacher. I think because I changed majors from economics to political science,
mm-hmm.
I had to play catch up on some courses,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't have enough elective time to have Dean Leyburn. I remember hearing him play the piano as I would walk by his house, or I remember seeing him on campus or in church, but I had no personal relationship with him, I'm sorry to say. But everyone that I have ever known who did have one found it an exceedingly rewarding relationship to have. He was really special. But I regret that I wasn't close enough to him.
I think it's very appropriate that the library is named for him.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How about fancy dress? Did you attend fancy dress?
Yes. To be honest, I don't remember too much about it. I think one of the slides I gave to you was Louis Armstrong at fancy dress, but no special memories. Just parties. Back then we had fall fancy dress and spring dances.
Mm-hmm.
No special memories.
Were you still wearing costumes then? Renting costumes for fancy dress?
I think so. I think one of the slides I did not bring to you was my girlfriend at that time and me, and we were in fancy dress. I remember another slide. I had a slide from a couple of years, and we were in fancy dress. Yes, I'd forgotten about that. Did they still dress in, did they do fancy dress, or is it tuxedos
today? It's we call it the fancy dress ball, but it's in tuxedos. Uh-huh. But we're hoping in 1999 to do fancy dress and costume.
Oh, that would be fun. Good.
And to go back to the original idea of it.
Good.
Of course, I hope that that'll be a, become permanent again.
Right.
I love costume parties.
Right.
Okay, how about this fraternity life you were involved in? Was that really important to you when you were a student?
Yes and no. I think fraternities at W&L have served and do serve a very worthwhile function of being sort of a microcosm of community within the larger W&L community, as small as that larger community is. And I think one of the reasons, and I'm sure we'll get to this in time, one of the reasons that I was so interested in the Fraternity Renaissance program is that I am a strong believer in the worthwhileness, if you will, of fraternities. That's the positive side. The negative side is that I was never very much of a party guy, and there was a real split, if you will, in my fraternity between a more conservative group who maybe, well, they didn't mind partying, but there was, to mention the other group first, there, when I was there in the late 50s, for some reason that I don't really understand, destroying things became rather in or fun, whether it was burning a piano or punching holes in walls or physically abusing the fraternity house itself. And I wasn't comfortable with that. I don't like it today. I didn't like it then. And so there was a lot of friction within my fraternity, the Sigma Nu fraternity, a lot of friction between a particular group of students who really liked to have a good time in what I would call a destructive way, and those who still like to have a good time, they didn't want an animal house environment, you might say. So there were some what I guess I would say very uncomfortable times and experiences. And that was the bad side to go along with the good. The good is I made friends that I still have. I think the sense of community that can exist is very positive. But there was a bad side that I think was really the beginning of what the Fraternity Renaissance program 25 years later tried to correct.
Had toga parties started when you were there?
Thank goodness, no.
That came right after you.
I don't remember. I don't remember when they started. But,
I've got pictures of them, and I think they were right after you. But
I don't
but
know.
For your senses, the animal house business had already started.
I believe that it started in the late 50s, almost 50. 58, 59, 60. I don't remember now why it started. But even though following World War II and some of the stories I heard of young men that came back after World War II who were older, I mean, they were wild, and they loved to party and all of that, but there was a kind, and I even heard of things like stealing trains and doing other things, and somehow I consider even stealing a train and driving it down the track 10 miles, I consider that more of a prank than doing something destructive to the dwelling that you're living in. And I think there was somehow in the late 50s, there must have been a loss of maturity or something, that change in behavior that resulted, and probably still results, in not so much at W&L, but other places, an absence of respect or caring about the community, the physical place where you live, and I had a hard time with that as a student, and I had many friends who did also, but there were some others, they didn't have a hard time with that at all.
Need to turn the tape over.
Okay.